There was a husband and wife. The husband's name was Herman, and his wife's name was Henrietta. And Henrietta, when they entered into the marriage, came with a large sum of money. She was very well-to-do, and throughout the marriage, she always reminded her husband, Herman, that everything they enjoyed was because of her. And so they built a home, and the day came when they were handed the keys, and they were walking through this incredible, opulent home, and they were walking from room to room looking at this incredible home that she had purchased. And she says, "Herman, if it were not for my money, we wouldn't be here." And Herman didn't say one word. Later that day, several trucks pulled up with furnishings for all the bedrooms, the bathrooms, the living room, and this truck began to unload all of these various forms of furniture and pictures, just all of this, and the house itself was just decorated. And as they were going from room to room, looking at all of it, Henrietta said, "Herman, if it were not for my money, this furniture wouldn't be here." And Herman didn't say one word. So at the end of the day, finally, one last truck pulled up, and within the truck was various pieces of this large entertainment console that was really the center of the house. They had this incredible stereo cabinet, big screens, you know, the whole system. And so they pieced together this incredible entertainment center that really was really the apple of the eye of the home. I mean, it was the thing that you focused upon. And as Henrietta was looking at it, she says, "You know what, Herman? If it wasn't for my money, we wouldn't have this furniture." And finally, at that point, Herman had had it. And he says, "Honey, I don't want to make you feel bad, but if it wasn't for your money, I wouldn't be here." Well, you know, that's really what this chapter, chapter 16, is all about. The theme of it is the use and the abuse of money. We have an entire chapter dedicated to this subject. It's a call to be wise and generous with the resources that God has entrusted to us. Here's a simple breakdown of the chapter. There's 3 points to it. We're going to look at verses 1 through 13 this morning, and we want to talk about preparing for the future, and we'll look at that in this parable. Then next time, we'll look at verses 14 to 18, the law of Moses and God's word. We'll see that what Moses had said was what Jesus had said and what Jesus would do. And then lastly, verses 19 to 31 is facing the future. You know, when you take the Bible and you add up all the various passages of the Bible that deal with money and resources, you come up with 2,350 passages in the Bible that deal with money and material possessions. Do you know that that's more than any other subject in the Bible? That is the predominant, believe it or not, it actually is. It's a predominant thought that the Bible addresses over and over and over again. Matter of fact, Jesus gave 38 parables during his 3-year ministry, and 12 of them had to do with money and resources. So when you take the 4 Gospels and you break them down, 1 out of every 8 verses of the Gospels deal with money and resources. Well, we come now to a chapter, an entire chapter that deals with this, the subject of our money and our resources. The weird thing about this particular parable, and I've said it at the beginning, it is under attack, and people have a hard time with this parable. They think, how in the world can Jesus compliment a crook? Matter of fact, Jesus even uses the word shrewd in this parable itself. The word shrewd is astute and discerning, is often what it's been defined as, but shrewd can also be defined as tricky and cunning. And each one of us will have to kind of figure it out this morning as we look at this parable, which definition fits best into what Jesus is giving here. Now, here's the thought of our passage this morning. Believers are blessed with resources that must be invested here and now, which ensure our eternal future. Everything we have this morning, if you're a child of God, is not yours. You are a manager. You are a superintendent. You are a steward. And you need to utilize those resources wisely. You need to invest in that which is eternal so that when you get to heaven, you've sent them ahead. That's what you got to do. And that's really the heart of this parable that Jesus gives. Now, here's how I want to break it down this morning. In verses 1 through 8 is the parable. Let's look at this controversial parable, and we'll talk about why it is, and we'll attempt to make some sense, because this is a first century parable, and it's not 20th century, it's first century, so its meaning is a little different. And then in verses 8 through 13 is the principles. We'll look at three principles that Jesus gives concerning our money and our resources. So let's pick it up here in verse 1, and let's look at the parable. Now again, Saturday night, Sunday morning, ccrialto.com. You know, you got the app right now. You open the app and you go to this week, you click on Sunday, there's four pages of notes that will be on your screen. We're going to put four pages of notes up today. Now, my wife and I were talking about this yesterday. It's like, this is like a no-brainer, you know? It's like, why would you want to write four pages of notes when you can just print it out? I mean, we're already going to provide to you the skeleton, the outline of the message, and so now you can inject the muscle, the sinew, and all the different little body parts and kind of put this skeleton, some flesh on it, and put it together. So I think bringing the notes, you know, put it in a binder, you know, you bring your Bible, you bring a pen. So when God's speaking to you, in between this outline, you can start to fill it in. Put a little thing there, God said this, this is what God is saying to me. And we could jot all of this stuff down. It will be very helpful to us, because why write what we're going to put up on the screen? You could write something else that God's going to personally speak to you. So I think that's really the way to go. I think that's the best way to go. And if you don't want to do it, you're wrong, so that's up to you. Okay, so let's look at verse 1. It says, now he was also saying to his disciples. Now notice that word now. Jesus has just finished a discourse. The entire 15th chapter has been often called the lost and found chapter. Now we know that that's not truly an accurate title for the 15th chapter. It really should be, which is too long, but let me give you the too long, what it should be. Lost, sought for, found, and rejoiced over chapter. That's what it should be called. I know that's a little lengthy, but that's really what the chapter is all about. In this, we find a lost sheep, a lost coin, and lastly, a lost son. The lost son was the worst of the worst because he was unchurched, he was unrighteous, he was rebellious. He told his father, he says, Dad, I wish you were dead so I could have my inheritance. Maybe you could be dead. Let me have my inheritance. And he basically took the money, went out and squandered it, wasted it. And then one day the light bulb came on and he goes, you know what? My dad's servants are doing a lot better than me. At least they got food to eat and shelter. I don't have anything. And so he headed back to his father, and his father, seeing him in the distance, runs to his son. He embraces him. And he forgives his son. So the whole basis of this chapter is because Jesus is welcoming sinners. They're coming to him. They're listening to him. He is speaking to them. He is loving them. And the Pharisees and the scribes are upset over this. They said, what is this? If he's a preacher of God, what's he doing loving on sinners? What's he doing preaching to sinners? So it's because of that that Jesus launches into this chapter about the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son to let us know that God actually seeks for those that are lost. And when he has found them, he rejoices over them. So really, when you look at this chapter, the religious are upset over Jesus for receiving sinners, but then the sinners are happy that Jesus would speak to them. So really what it comes down to is there are people who will receive the message and there are people who won't. And that goes the same way this morning. There are people here this morning that are going to receive what's going to be said, and there's some that aren't. You're just going to have all sorts of different reasons why you are not going to receive it, why you don't have to implement it, why you don't have to give it a second thought. You'll have your reason. But there will be others, on the other hand, that will say, wow, I certainly needed this. I needed to get my perspectives altered a bit, and so you'll be thankful for it. Well, so it is. It's also no accident that in the 15th chapter, in the 13th verse, we read about the prodigal son, that he squandered his estate with loose living. So we see an abuse of our resources in the 15th chapter. And it's also not a accident that in the 16th chapter, after our parable, in verse 25, we read the words, "But Abraham said, child, remember that during your life you receive your goods, your good things." So it was an individual that used his goods and his resources on himself. So right in between is this parable of this unrighteous manager. And so it says that now he was also saying to the disciples. Now this is a change because the 15th chapter was a result of the Pharisees and Sadducees grumbling at Jesus, upset with Jesus, and Jesus then launches into those parables along with the multitude listening in. But now we read, he was also saying to the disciples. So now Jesus addresses this to his disciples. But I want you to note something. Drop down to verse 14, and I want us to keep this in mind. Look at verse 14. "Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. And he said to them." So even though this is addressed specifically to disciples, because he's going to talk about how a disciple manages God's resources, God's money, it is the Pharisees that are listening to all of this. So they're in the audience, and they're listening to what Jesus said. And at the end, they start mocking Jesus, scoffing at Jesus, and that's their attitude towards him. So Jesus launches into this parable, and he simply says it this way, "There was a rich man." Okay, there it is. That's all it says. Now the question, this is where we start getting ourselves into, how did he get his money? Well, it doesn't tell us. Did he get it through honest means? Did he just invest? Was he given all of this wealth and property through an inheritance? Did he land grab? I mean, it doesn't tell us. It just simply mentions that there was a rich man. Now, as we read into the parable, he is a rich landowner who is leasing his land to those that are sharecroppers. They're basically taking the land that he's leasing to them, and they are planting olive trees, they're planting wheat, and then for the use of the land, they will then give a portion back to the landowner. This is how the landowner made a profit. This is how he made money. And we'll see this as we get into it. But all it simply says is that there was a rich man. And then it says who had a manager, which was a superintendent or a steward. A steward is someone who manages something that belongs to someone else. He does not own it, but has the privilege of enjoying it and using it for the profit of his master. So what this steward, this manager, and the superintendent did was he managed the tenant farmers. He was the one that made the lease with them. He was the one that collected when they had a field of wheat. He would collect a certain percentage of the wheat that they harvested. Those that we'll see had olive groves, he would collect so much of the oil to recoup from leasing the property and the trees to these farmers. So pretty common for a person that is wealthy to have a steward. Some of you remember back in Genesis chapter 24, verse 2, a steward named Eliezer. Eliezer was Abraham's trusted steward. Matter of fact, he was so trusted, Abraham sent him to pick out a bride for his son Isaac. Can you imagine picking your BFF to go pick a bride for your son? I mean, that's what he did. That's how trusted he was in Genesis 24:2. There's another character in the Bible that you will recognize. Maybe you haven't thought of him in this way. Maybe you have. Joseph. Joseph in Genesis 39:6 was a steward, a superintendent, or a manager under Potiphar. And Potiphar was an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard. Everything that he had was put in the hands of Joseph, and the only thing that Potiphar ever thought about was what he was going to eat. Everything else was put into Joseph's hand. So Joseph is an example of a steward, a good steward. Eliezer is an example of a good steward. And so it mentions here, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. The word squandering means to throw in the air or to throw away. Let's do a 2022 vernacular. He wasted his master's resources. He wasted it. He did not invest. He did not collect. He overspent. He simply took the resources that belonged to his master and he began to squander and use those upon himself. Now, how could this happen? How could a person like this that is so trusted, how could a person that's given so much power resort to such a thing? Let me just say this, and we'll get into this in a few moments a little deeper. I think at some point along the way, he started to look at those resources as being his. He started to think himself as the owner of the property. He was the recipient and the owner of the leases. Since he was given the authority, he thought he could do what he wanted to do. And that's dangerous, and we'll see this in a moment. This happens in the fellowship. It happens quite frequently. We start to think that we're the owner. So verse 2 says, "And he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you?'" Now, the word "you," underline the word "you." It's an interesting word. In the Greek, it expresses shock or betrayal. So it could literally be said like this: "You of all people, have you betrayed my trust?" That's what he said. The least expected one. Did you betray me? Did you, my trusted steward, betray me? The boss, the owner, is literally what he said. We would use the term, he called them on the carpet. That'd be kind of the term that we would use. So his boss says, "Give an account or give an audit of your management, for you can no longer be manager." So the owner says, "Give me the records, give me the ledgers. You're not fired yet." And we'll see, he hasn't been fired yet, because he's going to call in people and he's going to adjust what they owe. So he still has the authority. He hasn't cleaned out his desk yet. But that's the direction it's going to go. He's going to lose this cush job. He's going to lose this incredible position that this individual had. Again, we keep in mind chapter 15, verse 13, the prodigal son squandered his estate with loose living. You see, the manager forgot that he was a manager, not the owner. Let me just say this morning. I know this may shock some of you. Did you know I have been here for 37 years and I am a interim pastor? How do you like that? I'm an interim pastor for 37 years. And you say, well, how can that be? I mean, interim pastor's 1 to 2 years. You've been here 37 years. You're still trying to figure out if you want to stay? I mean, what do you mean is this interim pastor? Because my position is temporary. I'm not the permanent pastor here. Jesus is. I'm simply a steward of the Lord. I'm a manager of the Lord. I'm a superintendent of the Lord. Someone's going to take my place. That's for sure. I'm not going to be here forever. So really, every pastor, every woman in the women's ministry, every man in the men's ministry, children's ministry, assistant pastors, youth, cafe, bookstore, we're all interim servants. Interim. Because there's a day coming in which we'll be excused. Someone will take our position. Some will take our place. And I tell you, as a pastor, I see this so often, where people start to think it's their ministry, It's their call. They do what they want to do. And someplace along the line, they've lost sight of the fact that they are a servant of God. A servant is fully given over to their master. That's what a servant is. Somehow along the way, they've lost the definitions. They've lost the purpose. They're floundering. And often these people get attitudes because everybody else won't allow them to do what they want to do. And it's a tragic place to fall into as a Christian, and it happens quite frequently. So here's an individual falling into that same trap. He's taking care of his master's business, he's taking care of the lease, he's collecting it all, and somehow in his mind, he thinks it's his. He can go spend it as he wants. He doesn't have to invest it if he doesn't want to. He can do what he wants because it's all his. And he's got wrong thinking is what he has. So verse 3 says, the manager said to him, "What shall I do? Since my master is taking the management away from me, I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to dig." So the manager thought about the future. Notice his thinking now. Jesus lets us into his mind, and he says, "What shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me?" Things are about to change. I'm about to be dismissed from my position, this trusted position. You see, one thing is certain about every person's future will include a dismissal from the present life to the unknown regions of eternity. Every single one of us one day will be dismissed from this body. We don't know when that will be. But a day is coming when we'll get our dismissal. That is a fact. That's an absolute fact. I don't know if you've heard the statistics. 1 out of 1 people die. Did you know that? How about this one? There are people dying today that have never died before. Wow. That's heavy. We're going to die. We're going to be dismissed. We're going to absolutely leave everything we have, and we're going to depart. We're going to be dismissed. And by the way, this is the key to the parable. We could get caught up in so many little fringe areas, but that's the key here. Here is this crooked person that realizes he's about to lose it all. That's the point. He's being dismissed. He's losing his position. That cush job that he's had, that he's enjoyed, that he's abused, it's all coming to a close. And this is the point of the parable. Here is a wicked person that gets a clue. He realizes this is what's going to happen. His ability to see what's coming and then to make a plan. Now think about this. This is an argument from the lesser. If a non-believer can do that, shouldn't we be doing that? If a non-believer knows they're going to die and they plan for that, how much more should we be planning? How much more? I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's really the point of the parable. Let's not lose sight of this. The fact that he's a crook. He is a crook. But that's not the point. Being a crook, he even sees the handwriting law. He sees at the end. So the manager acknowledges the reality before him. Now, he could have said, "Oh, my boss, he's threatened to can me a bunch of times." It's always on a Monday. Mondays are bad for my boss. He always gets an attitude on Monday, and he wants to quit. He wants to fire. So, or, you know, he could have said, "You know what, I've been in some really tough spots throughout my life. I've always been able to work my way out. I've always had a plan. I've always been able to kind of pick myself up and go on and so forth." And so he could have taken that, but that's not what he did. He acknowledged this is reality. This is real. I haven't lost my job yet, but I'm going to. I'm going to clean out my desk. This is actually happening. This is going to happen. So the application for us is that someday all of us are going to stand before God and the ledger's going to be open. Now, the Bible doesn't use the term ledger. In Revelation 20, it calls it books. Books are going to be open for the non-believer. And the books are going to be open that are going to reveal, no doubt, opportunities for salvation, the useless words, the deeds that we committed. But a believer is going to be rewarded as to what they've done with the Lord. So there's a day coming in which the ledger is going to be looked at. And it's so amazing to me, this is so basic, but we live in this age of relativism where in our mind, we can have conflicting thoughts and views running around in our mind, and somehow we think it's acceptable. So we may say, as Easter's coming, was it necessary for Jesus to rise from the dead? Ah, maybe, maybe not. Is Jesus the only way to salvation? Maybe, maybe not. Was Jesus a member of the Trinity? Ah, maybe, maybe not. We have all of these conflicting ideas and notions running through our mind, but we never take the time to say, you know something, I better give this some thought. I better really consider this teaching, this doctrine. I need to consider it because it has to do with my eternal state. So he comes to the conclusion, he says, you know, I am not strong enough to dig. I can't do manual labor. I just can't do it. My name's not Manuel anyway. So I really can't do it, you know. These hands have been holding on to a pen and parchments, and I really can't do that. The next is, I'm ashamed to beg. Well, there's a lot of people that aren't. Have you ever noticed that? There's a lot of people, you know, the on-ramps, the off-ramps. There's a store by our house, and there's this big sign that says no panhandling, and people stand 3 feet in front of it and panhandle. I've often thought of taking a picture of that. It's so ironic. You know, my car broke down, I need gas, and they don't even have a car. And just all of these different things that people do. A pastor was telling me some time back, he said there was a guy on the freeway off-ramp, and he was holding up a sign, and the sign read, I won't lie, I want money for beer. And guess what? People were giving him money. I'm going to support this honest person, you know. And that's what they did. And so here is a person that realizes this is going down. This is going to happen. So look at verse 4. I know what I shall do. So concern for the future means actions. Notice the word know here in verse 4. It's an interesting word. It speaks of a sudden knowledge. Sometimes we use the term, I got a eureka. You know, you got this thought that comes to your mind, and you go, ah. Oh. Well, that's what this guy did. This guy had an idea. He had a plan. He thought of a solution that would help him with his impending fact of being fired. And so here's a guy that knows that he's going to be fired, so he makes a plan. What is it with us? I mean, we have a society. You can get insurance for everything. Why do we have insurance? Because people know things can happen, right? I can't remember who it was. It was an actress. She had her legs insured for like millions of dollars. You know why? Her legs were her life. That was her legs. So earthquake insurance, I mean, who can really afford it? I mean, I've heard people say, well, why get it? Because if an earthquake comes, the whole place will be leveled anyway. So it's like, what the heck, you know? And so, you know, and there's insurance for all sorts of stuff. Malpractice insurance. My wife and I were talking yesterday about this prenuptial agreement. I mean, any person that has to have a prenuptial shouldn't get married. If you're not willing to trust your spouse with everything because you're going to turn everything over to them, if you're not willing to do that, you should marry that person. Well, that's sort of their insurance policy because they don't know what they might do. Well, you're obviously not ready for marriage. It's a commitment for life and death. That's what it is. You commit everything. So we have insurance for all sorts of stuff. Things that will probably never happen. And for us, of course, in the mountains, you live out in the mountains, the insurance has gone up 3 times what it used to be because of the fires, the recent fires, and it's hard to get insurance. And then the state has to come in and offer a portion of the insurance because no agency will. Then they're all complaining, we have no money. And they're doing great. So that's what they do. And so you have insurance because things can happen. So here's a person that knows it's going to happen. This is absolutely going to happen. So verse 5 says, and he summoned each one of his master's debtors. And he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? So he calls in these tenant farmers And he realized that, okay, you know, we have this lease with you, and the lease says that, you know, you're over this, you know, these olive trees, and a portion of that olive trees means that you owe us olive oil. Another one, you have acres and acres of land that you have tilled, and you've turned it into wheat, so part of your lease is to give back to us a portion of the wheat. And so he realizes, you know what, I need to do something here. So he says in verse 6, he says, 100 measures of oil. Now, this is hard for us because we don't know what the measures are, but one individual noted that that's 900 gallons of olive oil. Now that tells us this was a large lease. This is a major chunk of property. One individual estimated that this would be at least 146 olive trees. So this lease was a large lease for an olive tree grove, because just the lease debt was 146 trees for a year. And he says, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Let's reduce it in half. I want to stop here for a moment. This is where people get all caught up in this, and they start saying, wow, how could Jesus commend this individual? So first of all, the rightness or the wrongness is not discussed here. And I want to say, we can look at this verse over and over and over again. Jesus is not in any way endorsing what this man is doing. Now, it doesn't mean that what he's doing is crooked. It doesn't mean that what he's doing is right. There just isn't any comment on it at all. He could be a crook ripping off his boss, or the more legitimate answer to it would be is that what he's giving up is his commission. Because the steward would have a commission in that lease. Since he's managing his boss's property, there would be a commission in there. So he could be giving up his commission. He could say, you know, it's worth it to give up my commission because it hurts me right now, but in the future, they're going to open their doors to me. They're going to say, that's the guy that reduced my debt in half. I owe this guy. Here's another flip side to this. Exodus 22, 25 and Leviticus 25, 36 tells us that it was illegal for a Jew to charge another Jew interest. So his boss, and what they would do is, they would not have a line item in the bill for interest. They would lob it in because they knew they couldn't do it. It was against the law to do it. So they would just simply say, you owe me, you know, 900 gallons of olive oil, when in reality, they really needed to only pay 450. So what he's basically doing is he's possibly outsmarting his boss. What's his boss going to do? Complain that his servant didn't collect the interest that he wasn't supposed to collect? Is that what he's going to do? So it's really a crook possibly outsmarting his boss. Or it's a manager saying, I'm going to forego my interest in order to get on the good side of those that have a debt to my master so they'll open their doors to me. So that's really what we're looking at here. We don't really know. But Jesus does not say that he's wrong in doing so. He simply says this guy uses his power to prepare for the future. Verse 7. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. That's 1,000 bushels of wheat. Now, another individual added this up and it says, that's about 100 acres. So this is some large property. So the payment's 100 acres of wheat. And he said, take your bill and write 8. Let's take 20% write-off. That's my commission, or that's the interest, my boss is charging, which is illegal. We'll just knock the interest off. That's what we'll do. Notice verse 7 now, this preparing to meet God. And then, so he makes this deal with them, and he says, okay, we'll just knock this 20% off. Verse 8 says, and his master praised the unrighteous manager because he acted shrewdly. Now, notice the wording here. He was impressed, but not pleased. So he was impressed with what he did. Wow. You withheld your commission. Or you took off the interest that was illegal. Whoa. Really, this steward's becoming the hero of the community. His boss even looks good because he's not charging the full amount. So here is this man now that is really prepared his future. People are going to open their doors to him. They're going to take care of him. He's got insurance for life. He's just helped some people out of a big debt. And so he's impressed. So we need to use the present opportunities to invest in that which is eternal. Now, I know, again, as I mentioned, this parable causes problems and people get upset with it and so forth. I think it's because most of us like good examples. We would like that this steward was an honest steward. He was a good steward and he did this, he did that. We like that. But you know, we can learn from both good and bad examples. And I think one individual in the Bible that was both was David. David's called the man after God's own heart. David loved God with all of his heart. But at the same time, David committed adultery. David committed murder. He was silent about it for a year. David was a bad parent. And so you look at David's life, and it's sort of a mixed bag. He was the man after God's own heart. No one really loved God like David. No one really sinned like David, and no one ever really repented like David. Because David, when he sinned, he would be broken, and he would repent. So sometimes we identify with his sins, but we don't identify with his repentance. So here is David, the man after God's own heart. He's a good example, also a bad example as a parent, also a bad example in sin, but a good example in repentance. And so David is sort of a mixed bag. He's kind of an interesting one to follow because he's a little of both. But this person here is a bad person. That's the point. He's a bad person. And whether what he did was wrong or not, the Bible doesn't tell us, but Jesus makes it clear that it was very wise what he did. And this brings us now to verses 8 through 13. The middle of verse 8 through the remainder is the principles. And there are three principles that are contained in these closing verses. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. So what Jesus talks about is being prudent and practical. The crook used intelligence and wit and energy to keep his earthly comfort. And you look at the world does this all the time. We just came back from Cancun, and I don't know if you know this. You go on a vacation to Mexico. You don't have to have a COVID test to get to Mexico, but you got to have a COVID test to get back home, which I find quite interesting. So as you walk across the street from the resort, they have these little makeshift trailers that are COVID testing. So the people know there that in order for you to return home, you have to have a COVID test. So right across the street is a COVID place. Get a COVID test for $100. But if you weren't checking around, you wouldn't realize that in your hotel it's only $15. So you go downtown, there's COVID trailers, there's signs, COVID test, COVID. And then if you get a positive, which some of you know happens a lot, I know someone here that took 3 tests and they came back different each time. It's always amazing to me. Oh, I'm sorry it came back positive. Take another test for another $100. See, this is how shrewd they are to their own. And you see this, you're going across country. Next service, 100 miles. Gas, $10 a gallon. I don't need my kids anyway. I'll just hawk them, get gas, That's what they do. Bottles of water, $3 for a 20-cent bottle of water. They're shrewd. They gotcha. They're going to make money. They're going to utilize this. They're going to utilize this, this going into the desert, this being separated from service. They're going to use it. This is how shrewd the world is. And the world does this with monetary money in order to make more money, in order to please themselves and to enjoy life here and now. And that's the point that Jesus is making here. And he says here that they are more shrewd in relation than the sons of light. So here we are. We know we're going to die. And how many Christians really invest in that which is eternal right now? When you die, you can't invest anymore. You're done. So if a non-believer knows that they only have a limited amount of time, they need to utilize, get what they can, and they do it, how much more, Jesus is saying, than the believer? So Jesus is saying, listen, believer, learn from the heathens. Look at what the heathen does. Look at what the pagan does. And we congratulate them for what they're doing because they know how to get the money. They know how to get it. They have a plan. They're going about it. Look at verse 9. I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwelling. So in verses 9 through 13, there are three principles to follow, and I want to mention these. The first one here is in verse 9, and the principle is, number one, use your money wisely. Use your money wisely. I say to you, so this is Jesus, this is God speaking here, make friends for yourself. There's two ways of looking at this when he says friends. He's talking about giving to God and giving to others. I think it's both. I think God is our friend, and there are others that are our friends, and we're giving to them. Daniel 12:3 says, those who have insight will shine brighter than the brightness of the expanse of the heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Use your wisdom. Give to God, give to his people, give to a cause for Bible and evangelism and missions. Notice he says, by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, or mammon. Riches are money. It's not only our money, but it's our resources. We can give we can open our homes, we can give what we have. We can give it unto the Lord. We're utilizing our resources for the next life. Notice he says, so that when it fails. Now, what does that mean when it fails? He's talking about death. Because the day will come, it doesn't matter how much money we have. When we die, money has failed. It can't be used anymore. It can't be invested anymore when we die. You can't take it with you, but you can send it ahead, is his point. One said, money is powerful, but it's temporal. So God over and over again gave examples to Israel about investing their money. I would ask the question this morning, are we investing in that which is eternal? Only we can answer that. What are we investing in? What are we thinking about? What is our goals? What does our future look like? So God gave a principle to Israel called the tithe, which is a tenth of all that they had, they gave to the Lord. But along with that was the temple tax, was the firstborn. Really, when you look at a committed Jew, they gave sometimes upwards of 37% of their income to the Lord. We like to talk about, oh, the tithe, the tithe, the tithe, the tithe. That's a starting point. In the New Testament, the Bible teaches grace giving. It teaches that everything we have belongs to God, so the question is, how much should we keep? Because it's all God's, not just 10%. It all belongs to the Lord. So I was thinking, you know, as I read the announcements, we got this Spring Fest that's coming at the end of this month. And the whole purpose of this spring, we've never done this before, the whole purpose of this Spring Fest is to revitalize and redo the playground. So we're hearing that right now, and all of a sudden we get one of those eurekas in our brain and say, you know what? I'm going to write a check for that playground. You could do that. I can't take this with me. I am going to bless the school and the church, and I want to bless them with a playground. We see what's going on in our world. I want to invest in Bibles. I look at the school. I want a scholarship, one child for next year. I'm going to pay an entire school year for a child that his parents can't afford it. We can do that. We can look around and say, I, you know what? God has so blessed me this month and this year. I am going to write a check to the church for this. Or I'm just going to say, wherever it's needed. That's what I'm going to do. Because I realize I can't take it with me. It's going to fail. So I might as well do it now while it hasn't failed. And I can give unto the Lord. See, this word fail means when you die. You can't use it anymore. So we give unto missions. We have a group that we have several folks that we support on a monthly basis, yearly basis. We're involved in missions, and we support them is what we do. Because we realize we can't take it with us. The money doesn't belong to the church. It's the Lord's. So how should we invest it to honor God and his kingdom? Again, Acts 20:35. This is an interesting verse. Paul says, in everything I showed you that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he himself said, it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. Do you know that there's no record of that in the Gospels? But Paul says, oh, Jesus would say this. There's no record of it. It was his life. He was a giver. His followers are givers. Notice that they may receive. Who is it that receives from our giving to the Lord and our giving to the church and our giving to charity? Who is it? I think it's a reference to angels, it's a reference to giving to God, and it's a reference to people. As we'll see in just a moment, when we get to heaven, we'll be greeted by those that we have blessed through our giving. We will be greeted by people saying, you know what? I was the one you bought the Bible for, and I was saved. I am the person down in Mexico that you helped. I am that person. See, that's what it is. We're literally sending it ahead. So when we get to heaven, he says here, into the eternal dwellings, we walk through the gates, John 14:2, my Father's house. We're greeted by those that have been blessed by our giving to the Lord and his program and his purpose. Listen to these words, 1 Timothy 6:17. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, and to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life eternal. Warren Wiersbe says, if God is our master, then money will be our servant. And we will use our resources in the will of God. But if God is not our master, then we will become the servants of money. And money is a terrible master. We will start wasting our lives instead of investing them. And we will one day find ourselves friendless as we enter the gates of glory. Well, that's a sad thought, isn't it? No one to greet us at the gates when we enter because we haven't invested in that which is eternal. I believe 2 seconds after we die, we're not going to say, was my last meal bread or a steak? That's not even going to be in our mind. We're not even going to think those thoughts. We're going to walk through those gates and we're going to see what we've sent ahead. That's what we're going to see. And that's the point that he's making. That's the point Jesus is making. We're going to see what our investment did. We sent it ahead. It's going to greet us. Verse 10 says, he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. This brings us to the second principle in verses 10 through 12. Prove trustworthy and faithful with resources. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also. Now, this is a two-edged sword, and let me tell you why. Those that are faithful see that the little things are as important as the big things. They see the eternal perspective. The small things matter. The manager was wise in preparing for the future, yet he lost his position because of unfaithfulness. So though he was wise in thinking to the future, he lost his position in a lack of faithfulness. So the positive is we can prepare for our heavenly future by helping others today. The negative is we can learn from the unethical behavior to be dependable in all that God entrusts with us. It's both. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Some of you remember, some of you weren't even born, when we had Bill Clinton as our president. And some of you remember the scandal with Monica Lewinsky. I'm telling you, during that scandal, I had a headache over this whole thing. It was the most bizarre thing, because here is a president that is lying under oath. And then you had these talking heads that were saying, why does it matter? Why does it matter if he was unfaithful to his wife, if he lied to the prosecution? Look at the good job he's doing. Why does it matter? I said, you people are stupid, is what you are. It's just stupidity. Because we're talking about a person's character. If he'll lie about Monica Lewinsky, he'll lie with the Secretary of State. That's the point. We're talking about someone's character. And that's the point that Jesus is making here. That you're not faithful in a very small thing, then you won't be faithful in a big thing, because a person that is faithful to God sees the little things as big things. And so verse 11 says, therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? So this is an argument from the lesser to the greater. Hudson Taylor says, a little thing is a little thing, but faithfulness in a little thing is a great thing. And that's his point, is that a righteous person sees the little things as being big things and being important. Verse 12, and if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Material, spiritual, we must remain faithful to God. Now let me ask the question, are we faithful this morning? And again, I mentioned this at the beginning, I kind of got ahead, but this is one of the areas that as pastors, we see this all the time, that people want to come and serve God on their terms. They want to serve God the way they want to serve God, and they want everyone to get on board with their program. What they fail to see is that they are stewards of God. They are managers of God. It's not theirs. It's not for them to tell God what they're going to do. And sometimes people get upset because we won't acknowledge where they should be or what they should be doing. And the sad part about that is that as leaders, we see the lack of faithfulness. Here, you don't even show up on a consistent basis on Sundays and you want to lead worship? What? You don't even show up on a consistent basis to the women's study and you want to teach? Am I missing something here? I mean, this is the attitude. This is the attitude that we have. We should be just thankful that they'll grace us with their talents, you know. And this is the point that Jesus is making. You know, it's great to think ahead. That's a noble thing. You did a great thing. But you're not faithful. And you'll lose out. You'll be replaced because you're not faithful. Though you had great wisdom to look to the future, you aren't faithful. Look at verse 13. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one, despise the other. You cannot serve God. Number three, principle number three. We will serve God or money. That's it. You can't serve God and money. It's one or the other. The two masters really can't be served adequately. Now, this is interesting. The word servant literally means one enslaved to the will of another. So how could you possibly be a servant of money and God when you can only be given to one? That's an oxymoron. Doesn't make sense. And that's his point. Mark Twain one time was debating with a Mormon over polygamy. And they weren't getting anywhere. And this Mormon was trying to convince Mark Twain that it was okay for a man to have multiple wives. Finally, he saw that he wasn't getting anywhere with Mark Twain. And so finally, the Mormon looks at Mark Twain and says, okay, let's settle this right now. Give me one verse in the Bible that forbids polygamy. I love Mark Twain. He looks at the Mormon and he says, that's easy. No man can serve two masters. Some of you got it. When you get home, your wife can explain it to you better than I can. But that's his point. You can't serve two masters. For either you will hate the one and love the other, be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. See, money is a good servant, but it's a bad master. It's a really bad master. You don't want to be under money. It's a bad master. 1 Timothy 6:9, but those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. I have seen it. I've seen it with pastors. I know pastors right now that are no longer pastors because they love money. They love money. They love money more than they love God. They're no longer pastors. If you think you're exempt from it, pastors aren't exempt from it. So by way of application, I want to close with just these three thoughts. Number one, let's look at these principles. Number one, use money wisely. Money is powerful, but it's temporal. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves. Number two, prove trustworthy, faithful with resources. The manager was wise in preparing for the future, yet he lost his position because of unfaithfulness. He was faithful in a very little thing, is faithful also in much. And then number three, we will serve God our money. No servant can serve two masters.